This way. You follow me.
Where are you taking me?
You want special pipe? I have for you. Make feel good.
Good. Special?
Huh? Only for special client. But as much money.
I have money.
Show me.
I have money. See? Money.
Here. Come here. Closer. Show me money.
Yeah, show money. Much money.
Closer.
Much money.
Much money.
The Man with the Twisted Lip by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio by Peter Mackey. With Clive Merrison as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Robin Herford as Hugh Boone. The Man with the Twisted Lip.
Despite my long association with Sherlock Holmes, our professional paths rarely crossed. Naturally, there were occasions when, in pursuance of some of the many criminal investigations we undertook together, my experience as a medical man was of especial value. But to be consulted as a doctor, and then find that my independent course of action brought me into direct contact with a case upon which Holmes was engaged, that was a rare event indeed. The particular adventure I have in mind first involved me at the end of a long and trying day at my practice. Mary, as I recall, was engaged with her needlework, whilst I must confess, was already glancing at the clock and contemplating the joys of a good night's sleep.
A patient. You'll have to go out.
Last.
John.
Oh, sorry, my dear. We heard the front door open, a few hurried words, and then quick steps upon the linoleum. Our own door flew open, and a lady, clad in some dark-coloured stuff, with a black veil, entered the room.
You will excuse my calling so late.
Why, it's Kate Whitney.
Oh, I'm in such trouble.
Kate?
I do so want a little help.
Oh, my dear, what is the matter?
I didn't know what to do, so I came straight to you.
Of course you did. It was very sweet of you. Now you must have some wine and water and sit here comfortably and tell us all about it. Or should you rather that I sent John off to bed?
Oh, no, no. I want the doctor's advice and help, too. It's about Isa. He's not been home for 2 days. I'm so frightened for him.
Mrs. Whitney, has your husband returned to his old habit? Has he taken to opium again?
Yes.
I feared he would.
Oh, but he tried, Doctor. And I know he tried to keep it from me, too. Well, up until now, his orgies have always been confined to one day, and he would come back twitching and shattered in the evening. But now, he's been away for 48 hours. What am I to do? Please, you must help me. Please.
Which den does he make use of?
It's near the docks. The Bar of Gold in Upper Swandam Lane. Oh, but how can I make my way into such a place?
And perhaps I could escort you. No, on second thought, I could manage it better if I were alone. Yes, as your husband's medical advisor, that is my responsibility. I believe I may still be able to influence him. If indeed he is at the address you have given me, you have my word. I will send him home in a cab within 2 hours. Oh,
please be careful, John.
Of course, my dear. I shall be as quick as I can. And so, in 10 minutes, I had left my armchair and cheery sitting room behind me, and was speeding eastward in a hansom on a strange errand, as it seemed to me at the time, though the future only could show how strange it was to be. Upper Swandam Lane is a vile alley lurking behind the high wharves which line the north side of the river to the east of London Bridge. Between a slop shop and a gin shop, approached by a steep flight of steps leading down to a black gap like the mouth of a cave, I found the den of which I was in search. Ordering my cab to wait, I passed down the steps, worn hollow in the center by the ceaseless tread of drunken feet. By the light of a flickering oil lamp above the door, I found the latch and made my way into a long, low room, thick and heavy with brown opium smoke, and terraced with wooden berths like the forecastle of an emigrant ship. At the farther end, there was a small brazier of burning charcoal, besides which, on a three-legged stool, there sat a tall, thin old man, with his jaw resting upon his two fists and his elbows upon his knees, staring into the fire. Through the gloom, I could dimly catch a glimpse of bodies lying in fantastic poses, bowed shoulders, bent knees, heads thrown back and chins pointing upwards, with here and there a dark, lackluster eye turned upon the newcomer. Out of the black shadows there glimmered little red circles of light, now bright, now faint, as the burning poison waxed or waned in the bowls of the metal pipes.
Give me coat. I bring you pipe.
Thank you. I have not come to stay.
Please?
There is a friend of mine here, Mr. Isa Whitney. I wish to speak to him.
God, what?
Leave us, please.
Very well.
It's all right, old boy. I'm here to help you.
I say, Watson, what o'clock is it?
Nearly 11.
Of what day?
Isa Whitney, brother of the late Elias Whitney, D.D., principal of the Theological College of St. George's, much addicted to opium. The habit grew upon him, as I understand, from some foolish freak when he was at college. For having read De Quincey's description of his own dreams and sensations, he had drenched his tobacco with laudanum in an attempt to produce the same effects. He found, as so many more have done, that the practice is easier to attain than to get rid of. And for many years he continued to be a slave to the drug, an object of mingled horror and pity to his friends and relatives.
Today is Friday, June the 19th.
Friday? Good heavens. I thought it was Wednesday. It is Wednesday. What do you want to frighten a chap for?
I tell you that it is Friday, man. Your wife has been waiting these 2 days for you. You should be ashamed of yourself.
So I am. Find out what I owe, Watson. I'm all off color. I can do nothing for myself.
I walked down the narrow passage between the double row of sleepers, holding my breath to keep out the vile, stupefying fumes of the drug, and looking about for the manager. As I passed the tall man who sat by the brazier, I felt a sudden pluck at my coat tail.
Walk past and then look back at me.
The words could only have come from the old man at my side, and yet as I glanced down, he sat as absorbed as ever, very thin, very wrinkled, bent with age, an opium pipe dangling down from between his knees, as though it had dropped in sheer lassitude from his fingers. I took 2 steps forward and looked back.
Good God!
The old man had now turned his back so that none could see him but I. His form had filled out. His wrinkles were gone. The dull eyes had regained their fire. And there, sitting by the brazier and grinning at my surprise, was none other than Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes? What on earth are you doing in this den?
As low as you can. I have excellent ears. If you would have the great kindness to get rid of that sottish friend of yours, I should be exceedingly glad to have a little talk with you.
I have a cab outside.
Pray send him home in it. He's too limp to get into any mischief. And also send a note by the cabman to your wife to say that you've thrown in your lot with me. If you'll wait outside, I shall be with you in 5 minutes.
It was difficult to refuse any of Sherlock Holmes' requests, for they were always so exceedingly definite and put forward with such a quiet air of mastery. In a few minutes, I had written my note, paid Whitney's bill, led him out to the cab and seen him driven through the darkness. In a very short time, a decrepit figure had emerged from the opium den, and for 2 streets, Holmes shuffled along with a bent back and an uncertain foot.
You know, Holmes, it's high time that you told me exactly what...
Shh, when we are safely around this next corner. Really, Holmes? I failed to find anything humorous in the situation.
I suppose, Watson, that you imagine that I've added opium smoking to cocaine injections and all the other weaknesses on which you favoured me with your medical views.
I was certainly surprised to find you in a place like that.
But not more so than I to find you.
I came to find a friend.
And I to find an enemy.
An enemy?
Yes, one of my natural enemies, or shall I say, my natural prey. Watson, I'm in the midst of a very remarkable inquiry, and I've hoped to find a clue in the incoherent ramblings of these sots as I've done before now. Had I been recognized in that den, my life would not have been worth an hour's purchase. I've used the place before now for my own purposes, and the rascally Lascar who runs it has sworn vengeance on me.
You mean the fellow I spoke with?
The same. The trapdoor at the back of that building, near the corner of Paul's Wharf, which could tell some strange tales of what's passed through it upon moonless nights.
You mean bodies?
Oh, yes, bodies, Watson. We should be rich men if we had £1,000 for every poor devil who's been done to death in that den. It's the vilest murder trap on the whole riverside, and I fear Neville St. Clair has entered it never to leave it more.
Mm. Who is this St. Clair fellow?
Yeah, one moment. Our trap should be here. Ah, there he is. Now, Watson, you'll come with me, won't you?
If I can be of any use.
Oh, a trusty comrade is always of use, and a chronicler even more so.
Where shall we be sleeping tonight?
In my room at the Cedars. It's a double-bedded one.
The Cedars?
At Mr. Sinclair's home. I'm staying there while I conduct the inquiry.
Where is it, then?
Near Lee, in Kent. We have a 7-mile drive before us.
Yes, but I'm all in the dark.
Of course you are. Well, you'll know about it presently. All right, John, we'll be driving ourselves. Jump up, Watson. Up there.
And we dashed away through the endless succession of somber and deserted streets, which widened gradually until we were flying across a broad balustraded bridge with the murky river flowing sluggishly beneath us. A dull rack was drifting slowly across the sky, and a star or two twinkled dimly here and there through the rifts of the clouds. Holmes drove in silence, with his head sunk upon his breast, and the air of a man who was lost in thought, while I sat beside him, curious to learn what this new quest might be, which seemed to tax his powers so sorely, and yet afraid to break in upon the current of his thoughts. We had driven several miles and were beginning to get to the fringe of the belt of suburban villas, when he shook himself, shrugged his shoulders, and lit up his pipe with the air of a man who has satisfied himself that he is acting for the best.
You have a grand gift of silence, Watson. It makes you quite invaluable as a companion.
What have you to say, sir?
That's a great thing for me to have someone to talk to, for my own thoughts are not over pleasant. I was wondering what I should say to this dear little woman tonight when she meets me at the door.
You'll forget that I still know nothing about it.
Then I shall just have time to tell you the facts of the case before we get to Lee. It seems absurdly simple, and yet somehow I can get nothing to go on. There's plenty of thread, no doubt, but I can't get the end of it into my hand. Now, I'll state the case clearly and concisely to you, Watson, and maybe you can see a spark, but all is dark to me.
Proceed, then.
But some years ago, to be definite, in May 1884, there came to Lee a gentleman, Neville St. Clair by name, who appeared to have plenty of money. By degrees, he made friends in the neighbourhood, and in 1887, he married the daughter of a local brewer, by whom he now has 2 children. He had no occupation, but was interested in several companies, and went to town, as a rule, in the morning, returning by the 5:14 from Cannon Street every night. And Mr. St. Clair is now 37 years of age, is a man of temperate habits, a good husband, a very affectionate father, and a man who is popular with all who know him. Am I going too fast, Watson?
No, not at all. Pray continue.
Last Monday, Mr. Neville St. Clair went to town rather earlier than usual, saying he would bring his little boy home a box of bricks. Now, by the merest chance, his wife received a telegram upon this same Monday to the effect that a small parcel of considerable value, which she'd been expecting, was waiting for her in the offices of the Aberdeen Shipping Company. Now, if you're well up in your London, you will know that the office of the company is in Fresno Street, which branches out of Upper Swandam Lane, where you found me tonight. So, Mrs. Sinclair had her lunch, started for the city, got her packet, and found herself at exactly 4:35 walking through Swandam Lane on her way back to the station.
Oh, not a pleasant neighbourhood for a lady.
No, no, indeed. Now, if you remember, Monday was an exceedingly hot day, and Mrs. Sinclair walked slowly, glancing about in the hope of seeing a cab. Then she heard a cry. She was struck cold to see her husband looking down at her, and, as it seemed to her, beckoning to her from a second-floor window. The window was open, and she distinctly saw his face, which she describes as being terribly agitated. He waved his hands frantically to her, and then vanished from the window so suddenly that it seemed to her that he'd been plucked back by some irresistible force from behind.
Extraordinary.
One singular point which struck her quick feminine eye was that although he wore some dark coat, such as he'd started to town in, he had on neither collar nor necktie. Convinced there was something amiss with him, she hurried down the steps, for the house was none other than the opium den in which you found me tonight, and running through the front room, she attempted to ascend the stairs which led to the second floor. At the foot of the stairs, however, she met that Lascar scoundrel who thrust her back and pushed her out into the street. Filled with the most maddening doubts and fears, she rushed down the lane and, by rare good fortune, met in Fresno Street a number of constables with an inspector, all on their way to the beat. The inspector and two men accompanied her back, and in spite of the continued resistance of the proprietor, made their way to the room in which Mr. Sinclair had last been seen.
And?
Exactly what happened then, I would like you to hear from Mrs. Sinclair herself. We are almost at the house. Suffice it to say, at this stage, Neville Sinclair was nowhere to be seen. In fact, in the whole of that floor, there was no one to be found save a sinister cripple. His name is Hugh Boone, and his hideous face is one which is familiar to every man who goes much into the city. A professional beggar, and such a piteous spectacle that a small rain of charity descends into the greasy leather cap which lies upon the pavement beside him. His appearance, you see, is so remarkable that no one can pass without observing him. A shock of orange hair, a pale face disfigured by a horrible scar, which, by its contraction, has turned up the outer edge of his upper lip, a bulldog chin and a pair of very penetrating dark eyes, which present a singular contrast to the colour of his hair, all mark him out from amid the common crowd of mendicants. So, too, does his wit, for he's ever ready with a reply to any piece of chaff which may be thrown at him by the passers-by. This is the man whom we now learn to have been the lodger at the opium den and to have been the last man to see the gentleman of whom we are in quest. Ah, here we are, the Cedars. Yes, and we're expected. There's still a light on.
So what did this cripple have to say for himself?
Both he and the Lascar stoutly swore that no one else had been in the front room during the afternoon.
Obviously lying.
Quite possibly, especially as traces of blood were to be seen on the windowsill and several scattered drops were visible upon the wooden floor of the bedroom. For the moment, Watson, just let me give you this thought. Well, there is only one entrance to that house in Swandam Lane, and all the back windows look directly onto the river, which was at its height at the time. When the mud was revealed once more, however, the police inspector found not Mr. Neville St. Clair, but a coat identified as belonging to him. And do you know why that coat had not been dragged away by the fierce currents of an ebbing tide, Watson?
Weighted in some way?
Every pocket had been stuffed with coppers. 421 pennies and 270 halfpennies. We must assume that the body, being less encumbered, was sucked away into the river. Ah, the groom will take care of our horse. Shall we go in? Mrs. Sinclair, may I present my colleague, Dr. Watson?
I'm delighted to see you.
Madam?
You will, I'm sure, forgive anything that may be wanting in our arrangements when you consider the blow which has come so suddenly upon us.
My dear madam, I am an old campaigner. And if I were not, I can very well see that no apology is needed.
Please, gentlemen, do take a seat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I should very much like to ask you one or two plain questions to which I beg that you will give a plain answer.
Certainly, madam.
Do not trouble about my feelings. I am not hysterical, nor given to fainting. I simply wish to hear your real, real opinion.
Upon what point?
In your heart of hearts, do you think Neville is alive?
Frankly, now?
Frankly, I do not.
You think that he is dead?
I do.
Murdered?
I don't say that. Perhaps.
And on what day did he meet his death?
On Monday.
Then perhaps, Mr. Holmes, you will be good enough to explain how it is that I have received a letter from him today.
What?
Yes, today.
Well, may I see it?
Certainly.
Oh, thank you. A Gravesend postmark, this morning's date, a coarse hand. Well, surely this is not your husband's writing, madam.
No, but the note inside certainly is.
I perceive also that whoever addressed the envelope had to go and inquire as to the address.
How can you tell that, Holmes?
The name, you see, is in perfectly black ink, which has dried itself. The rest is of a greyish colour, which shows that blotting paper has been used. Oh. And if it had been written straight off and then blotted, none would be of a deep black shade. Now, this man has written the name, and there has been a pause before he wrote the address, which can only mean that he was not familiar with it. It is, of course, a trifle, but there is nothing so important as trifles. Now, let us now see the letter. Ah, yes, there's been an enclosure here.
Yes, there was a ring, his signet ring.
Yes, I see. Dearest, do not be frightened. All will come well. There is a huge error which it may take some little time to rectify. Wait in patience, Neville. Written in pencil upon the flyleaf of a book, octavo size, no watermark. Posted today in Gravesend by a man with a dirty thumb, and the flap has been gummed, if I'm not very much in error, by a man who'd been chewing tobacco. And you've no doubt it's your husband's hand, madam.
None. Neville wrote those words.
Well, Mrs. Sinclair, the clouds lighten, though I should not venture to say that the danger is over.
But he must be alive, Mr. Holmes.
Well, unless this letter is a clever forgery to put us all on the wrong scent. The ring, after all, proves nothing. It may have been taken from him.
No, no, it is his very own writing.
Very well. It may, however, have been written on Monday and only posted today.
That is possible.
If so, much may have happened between.
Oh, you must not discourage me, Mr. Holmes. I know that all is well with him. There is so keen a sympathy between us that I should know if evil came upon him. On the very day that I saw him last, he cut himself in the bedroom, and yet I, in the dining room, rushed upstairs instantly with the utmost certainty that something had happened. Do you think that I would respond to such a trifle and yet be ignorant of his death?
I have seen too much not to know that the impression of a woman may be more valuable than the conclusion of an analytical reasoner. But if your husband is alive and able to write letters, why should he remain away from you?
I cannot imagine. It is unthinkable.
And on Monday he made no remarks before leaving you?
No.
And you were surprised to see him that afternoon at the window?
Very much so.
Had he ever spoken of Swandon Lane?
Never.
Had he ever showed signs of taking opium?
Never.
Yes, very well. Now, you say you thought he was pulled back from the window.
He disappeared so suddenly.
Yes, we might have leapt back. Could you see anyone else in the room?
Not from the street.
Mrs. Sinclair, please think carefully and then tell us precisely what happened from the moment you entered the second floor room with the inspector and his men.
Very well. As you will recall, several minutes had elapsed before I was able to secure the assistance of the police in Fresno Street and return with them to the house in Swandam Lane.
Stay by the door, Auden.
Very good, sir.
Tompkins, search the other room.
Sir.
Now, who are you?
I am owner of house.
Then I want to talk to you. But you, I do know. What are you doing in here, Boone?
I live here.
Threadneedle Street, that's your pitch, isn't it?
That's right.
Well, how long you been back here, then?
20 minutes, thereabouts.
This lady says she saw another man in here about 5 minutes ago, in the window there.
Been no one here but me and the landlord.
What do you say to that?
It is truth.
I see. Mrs. Sinclair, you sure it was this window?
Perfectly sure.
And sorry to have to ask you this, madam. It was your husband you saw.
Of course, I should know.
This is the second floor, Mrs. Sinclair. Can you be sure of that?
I'm his wife, Inspector.
Quite. Well, Boone, you've heard what the lady said.
Olivia, I should know. There's been no other party here. Just me and him.
He's lying. Neville was here. I know it.
All right, Mrs. Sinclair. I'll take a look around. What's in this cupboard, Boone?
A few bits and pieces. Not much.
Let's take a look, shall we? A few bits and pieces, eh? Well, I wouldn't have thought children's toys was in your line of business.
What do you mean?
I suppose you're going to tell me you've never seen these building bricks before.
Neville said he...
Yes, Mrs. Sinclair?
My husband said he would buy a present for our little boy today. He has been here.
I've never seen them before, I tell you.
In here, Inspector.
Bring him along, Warden.
Right, sir.
I've done nothing, I tell you.
That's enough.
You
that,
what is it, Tompkins?
found these behind the curtain there, sir.
Boots, socks, hat, watch. Mrs. Sinclair?
Yes. They are my husband's.
Are you all right, madam?
I...
Now, you better sit down.
I should be all right, Inspector.
All right, Boone. What do you know about this?
Nothing. Oh, I swear, I've never seen those clothes before.
Did you open this window, Tompkins?
No, sir.
Let's have a look, then.
River's high.
Come here, Boone. I said here. What's this, then?
Where?
On the sill there. Blood.
It's mine. See? Oh, my hand. I cut myself earlier.
So you have. But who's to say that's your blood on the window? Who's to say it's not from Mr. Neville Sinclair?
No.
After you cut his throat and pushed his body into the river.
No.
You Boone, I arrest you for the murder of Neville Sinclair.
But I'm innocent, I tell you. I've never seen this thing.
Say in devastation.
No, it's a mistake. He was never here.
That's enough from you.
Yeah, and I want to see you again later.
I'm not going away, sir.
Just make sure you don't.
I'm innocent, I tell you. Innocent.
At that moment, then, you believed your husband dead.
Yes. You know what agony and grief these last few days have held for me, Mr. Holmes. Yeah. But today, this letter, the relief of knowing he is alive.
But not where he might be.
Neville has good reason for keeping that from me, Mr. Holmes. For the moment, it is enough to know he will return to his family. He has asked me to be patient, and I will. And now, if you will excuse me, Mr. Holmes, it has been a long day.
Of course. My apologies for keeping you up so late.
Your supper has been laid out in the dining room.
Oh, that'll be most welcome. And then we too must retire, Watson. I suspect we may have a busy day tomorrow.
A large and comfortable double-bedded room had been placed at our disposal, and I was quickly between the sheets, for I was weary after my night of adventure. Sherlock Holmes was a man, however, who, when he had an unsolved problem upon his mind, would go for days and even for a week without rest. It was soon evident to me that he was now preparing for an all-night sitting. He took off his coat and waistcoat, put on a large blue dressing gown, and then wandered about the room, collecting pillows from his bed and cushions from the sofa and armchairs. With these, he constructed a sort of Eastern divan, upon which he perched himself cross-legged, with an ounce of shag tobacco and a box of matches laid out in front of him. In the dim light of the lamp, I saw him sitting there, an old briar pipe between his lips, his eyes fixed vacantly upon the corner of the ceiling, the blue smoke curling up from him, silent, motionless, with the light shining upon his strong-set aquiline features. So he sat as I dropped off to sleep, and so he sat when a sudden ejaculation caused me to wake up, and I found the summer sun shining into the apartment. The pipe was still between his lips, the smoke still curled upward, and the room was full of a dense tobacco haze, but nothing remained of the heap of shag which I had seen upon the previous night.
You'll wake, Watson.
Oof. Well, adjust. What time is it?
4:25.
4:25?
It's game for an early morning drive.
Well, I suppose so.
Now then, dress. No one's stirring yet, but I know where the stable boy sleeps, and we shall soon have the trap out.
What's all this about, Holmes?
I want to test a little theory of mine. I think, Watson, that you are now standing in the presence of one of the most absolute fools in Europe who deserves to be kicked from here to Charing Cross. I confess that I have been as blind as a mole, but it's better to learn wisdom late than never to learn it at all. I think I have the key of the affair now.
And where is he?
In the bathroom.
Oh, come, Holmes, it's too early.
Not joking. I've just been there. I've taken it out, and I've got it in the Gladstone bag. Come on, old boy, and we shall see whether it will fit the lock.
We made our way downstairs as quietly as possible, and out into the bright morning sunshine. In the road stood our horse and trap, with a half-clad stable boy waiting at the head. We both sprang in, and away we dashed down the London road. A few country carts were stirring, bearing in vegetables to the metropolis, but the lines of villas on either side were as silent and lifeless as some city in a dream. In town, the earliest risers were just beginning to look sleepily from their windows as we drove through the streets of the Surrey side. Passing down the Waterloo Bridge Road, we crossed over the river, and dashing up Wellington Street, wheeled sharply to the right and found ourselves in Bow Street.
Who is on duty?
Inspector Bradstreet, sir.
Thank you. Ah, Bradstreet, how are you? I wish to have a word with you.
Certainly, Mr. Holmes. Always a pleasure to see you. And Dr. Watson, of course. Please step into my room.
Thank you. How's the family, Bradstreet?
Oh, very well, thank you, Doctor. Now, what can I do for you, gentlemen?
We've called about that beggar man, Boone. The one who was charged with being concerned in the disappearance of Mr. Neville St. Clair of Lee.
Oh, yes. Brought up and remanded for further inquiries.
So I heard. You have him here?
Where else? Quite a regular guest in the Bow Street cells is our Mr. Boone.
Yes, you speak as though you've developed a certain rapport with the man.
Oh, I don't know about that, Mr. Holmes. But I do know I've run him in quite a few times over the years. Last occasion, couldn't have been more than a couple of weeks back.
Matches, madam. Matches for the light of your life. No, as you like. Oh, matches, sir. Box of... morning, Mr. Bradstreet, sir. I was just going...
There was only one place you're going, Boone.
There's no need for that, Mr. Bradstreet. I'm not hurting anyone.
It's a matter of opinion.
Well, if it's my opinion you want.
All right, Boone, that'll do. On your feet.
Very good, Mr. Bradstreet. I've just put my matches away.
Be quick about it.
Oh, here's my stock. Must look after that. Proper street trader I am, not like them round the corner. Just beggars they are. They're the ones you want to get off the streets.
I'll be the judge of that.
And all be the judge of me.
We'll just have to see, won't we? Well, I don't know what you're worried about. Looks like there's enough in your cap, whatever the fine is.
Yes, I think you're right there. Now, Mr. Bradstreet, ready when you are.
They're more than just a fine this time, I shouldn't wonder.
Tell me, Inspector, is he quiet?
Even more than usual, Mr. Holmes. Though he never really gives us any trouble. But he's a dirty scoundrel. Still, once this case has been settled, he'll have a regular prison bath. I think if you saw him, you'd agree with me he needed it.
I should like to see him very much.
Well, that's easily done, Mr. Holmes. I'll take you down myself. You can leave your bag here if you like.
No, I think that I'll take it.
Very good. Right, gentlemen.
Bradstreet led us down a passage, opened a barred door, passed down a winding stair, and brought us to a whitewashed corridor with a line of doors on each side.
There he is, sleeping like a baby. Care to take a look, gentlemen?
Thank you.
As we took our turn at the grating, I saw that the prisoner lay with his face towards us in a very deep sleep, breathing slowly and heavily. He was, as the inspector had said, extremely dirty, but the grime which covered his face could not conceal its repulsive ugliness. A broad weal from an old scar ran right across it from eye to chin, and by its contraction had turned up one side of his upper lip, so that three teeth were exposed in a perpetual snarl. A shock of very bright red hair grew low over his eyes and forehead.
He's a beauty, isn't he?
Mm. He certainly needs a wash. I had an idea that he might, and I took the liberty of bringing the tools with me.
You're a funny one, Mr. Holmes.
If you'll have the great goodness to open that door very quietly, we will soon make him cut a much more respectable figure.
I don't know why not. He doesn't look a credit to the Bow Street cells, does he?
The cell we entered was barely large enough to accommodate the prisoner, let alone the three of us. Motioning Bradstreet and I to be silent, Holmes went first to the cell's water jug, and then, crossing to the sleeping figure, rubbed the now moistened sponge vigorously to and fro across Boone's face.
So much for the paint. Now for the plaster. And finally, the wig.
What's the meaning of this?
Let me introduce you to Mr. Neville St. Clair of Lee in the county of Kent.
And there, sitting up in his bed, was a pale, sad-faced, refined-looking man, black-haired and smooth-skinned, rubbing his eyes and staring about him with sleepy bewilderment.
Well, who would have thought it? I know him from the photograph.
Oh, be it so. But if I am indeed the missing man, what am I charged with?
With making away with Mr. Nevelson. Oh, you can't be charged with that unless they make a case of attempted suicide of it.
And I've been 27 years in the force, but this really takes the cake.
If I am Mr. Neville Sinclair, then it is obvious that no crime has been committed and that, therefore, I am illegally detained.
No crime, but a very great error. You would have done better to have trusted your wife.
It was not my wife. It was the children. God help me, I would not have them ashamed of their father. My God. What an exposure. What can I do?
Calm yourself. We will find a solution. If you leave it to a court of law to clear the matter up, of course you can hardly avoid publicity. On the other hand, if you convince the police authorities that there's no possible case against you, I don't know that there's any reason that the details should find their way into the papers.
God bless you. I would have endured imprisonment, aye, even execution, rather than have left my miserable secret as a family blot to my children.
Might I suggest, Mr. Sinclair, that you now tell us the circumstances that brought you into this predicament?
Of course. You are the first who has ever heard my story.
Perhaps we should hear it in my office. After all, Mr. Sinclair, we can hardly consider you a prisoner any longer, can we? This way, if you please.
My father, gentlemen, was a schoolmaster in Chesterfield, where I received an excellent education. I travelled in my youth, took to the stage, and finally became a reporter for one of the London evening papers. One day, my editor wanted a series of articles upon begging in the metropolis, and I volunteered to supply them. I decided it was only by trying begging as an amateur that I could get the facts upon which to base my articles. When an actor, I had, of course, learned all the secrets of making up. I took advantage now of my attainments and painted my face. And, to make myself look as pitiable as possible, I made a good scar and fixed one side of my lip in a twist by the aid of a small slip of flesh-coloured plaster. Then, with a red head of hair and an appropriate dress, I took my station in the business part of the city. For 7 hours I plied my trade, and when I returned home in the evening, I found to my surprise that I had received no less than 26 shillings and 4p.
Just for sitting on your backside all day.
Yes. Please continue, Mr. Sinclair.
I wrote my articles and thought little more of the matter until, some time later, I backed a bill for a friend and had a writ served on me for £25. I was at my wit's end where to get the money. But a sudden idea came to me. I obtained a fortnight's grace from the creditor, asked for a holiday from my employers, and spent the time in begging in the city under my disguise. In 10 days I had the money and had paid the debt. Well, you can imagine how hard it was to settle down to arduous work at £2 a week when I knew that I could earn as much in a day by smearing my face with a little paint, laying my cap on the ground and sitting still. I tell you, gentlemen, it was a long fight between my pride and the money.
But the money won at last, eh?
To my shame. Only one man knew my secret. The Lascar who keeps the opium den in Swandam Lane. He also gave me the use of 2 second-floor rooms, though I had to pay him well to keep my secret safe.
19 and 6, £4. There you are.
Thank you, Mr.
Boone. Hugh Boone.
Of course. But Mr. Boone is not enough.
How do you mean?
You give £5 now, please.
No, it's too much.
No. Not too much. Not for Mr. Boone. Mr. Boone gets much money.
I paid, of course. And so I continued to emerge every morning as the squalid beggar, and in the evenings transform myself into the well-dressed man about town. Very soon I found that I was saving considerable sums of money. I do not mean that any beggar in the streets of London could earn £700 a year, which is less than my average takings, but I had exceptional advantages in my power of making up, and also in a facility in repartee, which improved by practice and made me quite a recognizable character in the city. All day a stream of pennies, varied by silver, poured in upon me. And it was a very bad day I failed to take £2.
As I grew richer, I grew more ambitious. Took a house in the country and eventually married without anyone having a suspicion as to my real occupation. My dear wife knew that I had business in the city, but she little knew what.
You fooled us all, Mr. St. Clair. I should think even the commissioner might have dropped a few shillings in your cap over the years.
Very probably. Well, last Monday, I had finished for the day and was dressing in my room above the opium den when I looked out of my window and saw, to my horror and astonishment, that my wife was standing in the street with her eyes fixed full upon me. I gave a cry of surprise, threw up my arms to cover my face, and rushing to my confidant, the Lascar, entreated him to prevent anyone from coming up to me. I threw off my clothes, pulled on those of a beggar, and put on my pigments and wig. Even a wife's eyes could not pierce so complete a disguise. But then it occurred to me that there might be a search in the room, and that the clothes might betray me. I threw open the window, reopening by my violence a small cut which I had inflicted upon myself in the bedroom that morning. Then I seized my coat, which was weighted by the coppers which I had just transferred to it from the leather bag in which I carried my takings. I hurled it out of the window, and it disappeared into the Thames. The other clothes would have followed, but at that moment there was a rush of constables up the stair, and a few moments after I found, rather I confess, to my relief, that instead of being identified as Mr. Neville St. Clair, I was arrested as his murderer. Well, gentlemen, I do not know there is anything else for me to explain. I was determined to preserve my disguise as long as possible, and hence my preference for a dirty face. Knowing that my wife would be terribly anxious, I slipped off my ring and confided it to the Lascar at a moment when no constable was watching me, together with a hurried scrawl telling her that she had no cause to fear.
That note only reached her yesterday.
Good God. What a week she must have spent.
We've been keeping a watch on that Lascar, so it would have been difficult for him to post a letter unobserved. Probably handed it to one of his sailor customers who forgot all about it for some days.
That was it. I have no doubt of it.
Mr. St. Clair, this begging must stop. If we are to hush this thing up, there must be no more of Hugh Boone.
I have sworn it by the most solemn oath which a man can take.
And in that case, I think it's probable that no further steps may be taken. But if you're found again, then all must come out.
I understand.
Then all that remains to say is we're very much indebted to you, Mr. Holmes, for having cleared the matter up. Though I wish I knew how you reached your results.
I reached this one by sitting on five pillows and consuming an ounce of shag. Watson, I feel there is just one more matter we must attend to before we can say this particular adventure has been brought to a satisfactory conclusion.
Ah, you mean we should let Mrs. St. Clair know all is well?
I think we can safely leave that to her husband.
Of course.
I was thinking more along the lines that if we drive with all possible haste to Baker Street, I believe we shall just be in time for breakfast. Good day, gentlemen.
In The Man with the Twisted Lip, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Merrison and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. Hugh Boone, alias Neville St. Clair, was played by Robin Herford, with Danielle Allen as Mrs. St. Clair, Emma Gregory as Kate Whitney, George Winter as Isa Whitney, Elizabeth Mansfield as Mary Watson, David Googe as Inspector Bradstreet, David Bannerman as Constable Tompkins, and Angus Wright as Constable Horden. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Man with the Twisted Lip was dramatized for radio by Peter Mackey, produced by Enid Williams, and directed by Patrick Rayner.